This is hashtag history episode 78. I'm Rachel.
And I am Leah.
Whoa. Hey.
I'm special.
Last week, we started a two-part series on Lance Armstrong, the only professional cyclist to win 7 Tour de France titles, all before it was revealed that he had been using performance-enhancing drugs in every single one of his Tour de France wins from 1999 to 2005.
Naughty Lance.
Yeah, so I definitely recommend checking out last week's part one episode if you have not done so yet, because it really lays the context for where we are headed with this week's episode. Particularly in last week's episode, we discussed the Festina affair and kind of just like the overall effect that that had on the Tour de France. Do you mind doing like a quick recap on that, Leah?
Yeah. So it was 1998.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the Festina team, that entire team, it was found. Well, one of the coaches was going to the Tour de France and
stopped at customs,
and they found all of these drugs and performance enhancing, like testosterone and all this stuff, needles, syringes, all this stuff in his bag because he's dumb and didn't check it. And then it opens up this can of worms where they go back to the Festina offices and they find even more drugs and more information on this is when we dope all of our team members and when and what to give them and how much.
Exactly.
And then it again opens up a can of worms where because of that, it's found out that other teams and other riders are also doping. And it just, it's like a systemic issue.
That's exactly it. And it was that led to the creation of the World Anti-Doping Agency and it just had an overall huge effect on professional sports, especially the Tour de France. So that's exactly it. And that's the world that Armstrong threw himself into when he competed and won his first Tour de France the following year in 1999. Mm-hmm. So we're going to start in 1999 this week, and then we're going to go all the way through his 6 other Tour de France wins and the downfall of his empire, I guess you could call it.
Yeah.
As his doping scandals would be revealed. But first, let's have a drink.
Let's drink.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And this is Hashtag History.
It's a podcast for both history nerds and history haters alike,
where we dive into history's greatest stories of controversy, conspiracy, and corruption.
I realized I meant to say this at the beginning or at some point in last episode. We have officially had 40,000.
Yes.
Sorry, I was trying to go slow so you would catch up with me.
No, I was I thought you were going to say, I don't know why, because I was tying it to the cocktail segment. I thought you were going to say, we have had 40,000 cocktails. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we've had 40,000 downloads.
This is insane.
More than 40,000. Actually, we've beyond exceeded that already today since I posted that a couple days ago.
Yeah.
So that is huge.
Yeah. I know we have a lot of episodes. You're on 78 right now.
We are on 78.
Yeah, you weren't sure, but that's still so many people.
I know. That's really cool.
Yeah, and which country is it that we're really big?
Costa Rica.
Shout out to Costa Rica.
I think we need to do a trip there or something, because seriously, we are always in their top 10, not just history podcasts, but podcasts.
Yeah.
Isn't that wild?
Costa Rica.
We're coming. We're coming once the Rona is over.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you. Yeah.
Of course.
Special.
So another shout out, not to Costa Rica, to this week's cocktail sponsor.
Yay.
Travel_historic on Instagram. That's their Instagram handle. They sent us a lovely message along with their Amula.
Yeah. Thanks for that.
Yeah, they said, my travel has been lacking for obvious reasons, but you ladies certainly fill my love of history. Aww. I absolutely adore that you seek out the history we don't know and aren't always focusing on the same stories we've been told time and time again. Cheers to you both. This one's on me.
That is so sweet. Thank you so much.
These yes, thank you for giving us money, but I really like the the nice comment.
I know. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you. So now on to the cocktail. I found a cute little article on differenceguide.com with a list of various Tour de France inspired cocktails.
Oh, cool.
Which I thought very appropriate. Obviously.
That sounds like that'd be super fun to just down for every single stage. If we were like watching the Tour de France, each stage we have a new themed cocktail.
No, and that's
cocktail.
What it was. Like, it was a specific year because you said the stages always change. But for each location they were at, they did like a cocktail based on that area.
That is cool.
And I simply chose the one that sounded the best to me. And you will see why very soon.
Based on the color of it, I can take a wild guess.
Yeah. So I will try to include the link to that on our Instagram or at the very least in the citations on our website for this episode. Mm-hmm. But in short, this cocktail contains vodka. If you have a citrus flavored vodka, that is what is preferred. We just did regular vodka. Uh-huh. Limoncello, which is my favorite.
It's and your I'm favorite.
Like, I was like, oh shoot, I need to buy a new bottle of limoncello. Dang it.
That was how we always touch base before we record to see like, all right, who do you have rum? Do we need to buy rum? Yeah. Whatever. And you know, limoncello was one of the things on the list. And Leah didn't even give me a chance to say like, I'm fine with buying that. She was like, this is mine. So I will gladly purchase.
Yeah. And then you top it off with lemon juice and simple syrup.
Oh my God, it sounds so amazing.
Yeah. I think it's going to be like a, I mean, how could it not be? Like a lemon drop.
Yep. Exactly what I was thinking.
And yes, I may or may not have planned an entire cocktail segment around a craving for limoncello. Sue me.
It is accepted. Thank you.
All right. You ready?
Yes. Okay. Cheers. And also, she put a beautiful sugar rim around it.
I was going to say, my sugar rim looks nasty compared to yours.
Mine is stunning. Cheers. Cheers.
Yeah, it's like a lemon drop.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a lemon drop?
A lemon drop is... It's just vodka, lemon juice, and like sugar, essentially. So this is the classier version.
Yeah. I think... And if I recall the reason in the article, the reason they chose it is part of the tour might have gone through some of Italy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yes. Which limoncello, like Italy. Yeah. So.
Love that. This is delish.
Oh my God. That's going to go down fast, though.
Mm-hmm. Very fast. In fact, we might just end the episode here.
Bye. Thanks for joining. Bye.
What's your rating?
Oh, 10. The only complaint is that it's not bigger. Right?
Completely agree. Completely agree. Couldn't agree more. Could not agree more. Yeah. It's in a beautiful martini glass, and so there isn't much... complaint is I wish it would last longer. All right, okay,
delish.
10. Thank you to our cocktail sponsor. Thank you to you for your limoncello.
Thank you to Difford's Guide.
Thank you to Difford's Guide. Thank you to the Tour de France.
Thank you to Lance.
No, we ain't going that far. That guy.
I mean, he did inspire this entire
that guy. All right. So it's 1999. Lance Armstrong, cancer survivor that was given less than a 50% chance at life, was competing in the Tour de France for the United States Postal Service team. Back then, they used to have a prologue race, which was essentially what it sounds like. It was a short time trial race that would not exceed 5 miles. Whoever won that race could claim race leadership for the official start of the Tour de France race the following day.
Why would you want to be the leader of the pack going... being the wind drafter or whatever.
You're at the front.
Yeah, working twice as hard as the people behind
you.
Correct,
but if you've seen the peloton, it is so effing hard to make your way through it to ever get a chance to get to the front.
Okay.
See?
Yep.
They stopped doing these prologue races in 2007, but in 1999, they were definitely still a practice, and Armstrong came out swinging, taking first place in the 1999 prologue.
He had something to prove.
He had something to prove. He would continue to dominate in the tour, winning 4 stages. And right off the bat, people were suspicious. I don't mean to be pessimistic. We all love, you know, an underdog story. But watching someone compete at the level that Armstrong was competing at, especially only a few years removed from his cancer treatment, was alarming to many.
Yeah.
He would end up winning the Tour de France that year by a full 7 minutes and 37 seconds, making him only the second American to win the Tour de France in its nearly 100-year history. Further fueling the skepticism, Armstrong was tested during the race, and it was widely reported by the media that officials had found a banned substance in his system, cortisone. And this here is like such a wild story. So we, of course, know now that he was using it intramuscularly as a performance enhancing drug. But at the time, several legal products such as eye drops or creams contained cortisone. The particular type of cortisone that Armstrong had injected could have been used in multiple ways or in a multitude of products. So he was able to easily brush this scandal off. He responded to the allegations that the only reason cortisone had been found in his system was because he was using a cortisone cream for saddle sores, something that was allowed.
It's embarrassing.
I mean, it's sort of embarrassing, sure, but also you sit on a bike all day. I'm sure they all have them. It's expected, yeah. Again, it is only because he was using this particular type of cortisone that he was able to lie and get away with it. Had he used the kind that could only be injected, which was a thing at the time, he would have been screwed.
Mm, so he's being smart with the drugs he's inserting.
Oh, he's clever.
His body.
Mm. He's clever, all right. We, of course, now know with retroactive testing that in addition to the cortisone, Armstrong's urine samples would also produce EPO. But still, in 1999, despite the World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA's, presence, there still was not reliable testing in place to detect EPO. Other skeptics would say Armstrong won not because of doping, but because the two leading champions in the cycling world, Italy's Marco Pantani, whom we talked about a little bit last week, and Germany's Jan Ullrich, did not compete in the 1999 Tour. Regardless of the skepticism, Americans were by and large overjoyed. When Armstrong returned to Austin, Texas, there was a huge hometown parade. He was on talk shows. He made it on the Wheaties box. He and his wife, Kristen, were expecting their first child. What more could you ask for?
Not doping.
That little thing.
Not a little cheating.
Yeah, that could be something you could ask for. Mm-hmm. Like we talked about in last week's episode, Armstrong really transcended the sport. Cycling was largely a European sport. Before 1980, there weren't even Americans competing in the Tour de France. That's kind of crazy to me.
That is crazy.
Before 1980, there weren't even Americans in the Tour.
Yeah.
When American George LeMond won the Tour in 1986, he wasn't just the first American to win the Tour. He was also the first non-European to win the Tour. Hmm. So Armstrong becoming the second American to win the Tour de France a little over a decade later was a huge, huge deal.
Yeah.
He would go on to win the Tour de France in 2000 with Jan Ullrich taking second. In fact, Ullrich would end up getting a record as the person to achieve second place the most number of times in the Tour de France, always behind Armstrong.
That's not a good moniker to hold.
I know, to be the like notorious second place guy.
Always the bridesmaid, never the bride.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that's that.
Yeah.
It was also in 2000 that Armstrong would publish his book titled It's Not About the Bike, which many people, particularly cancer survivors, found really inspirational.
Yeah, that's good.
No, a lot of people found it really inspirational. But of course, this book also, you know, contained denials regarding doping and speaking ill of those that had accused him personally of doping.
And probably wasn't actually written by him. It was probably like ghostwriter type deals.
They never are.
Yeah.
Armstrong would win the Tour de France again in 2001, 2002, and 2003. Although it did look for a brief moment there in 2003, like Armstrong might not take the win. I want you to look here. So we're checking out the 2003 footage from the 2003 Tour de France during stage 15.
Oh, Lance. Oh, he hit someone.
He caught her handbag.
Yeah. Well, get your shit out of the route.
Yeah, I'd be pissed at that spectator. But yeah, like her souvenir handbag was too far out. His right handlebar ends up catching.
Could you imagine being that woman?
I can see it going two ways, being like, oh my god, I hate myself, or also being like, oh my god, I touched Lance Armstrong. Right?
Yeah.
So even though, like, you saw what happened in that video, that he like fell, took other people down.
Well, now I want to see him like somehow getting back to the lead.
He does, because he ends up winning not only that stage but also the entire tour.
All right.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, because he's on drugs.
So he was constantly under suspicion, though. An Irish sports writer named David Walsh would write articles about Armstrong's suspicious relationship with Dr. Michele Ferrari, the controversial doctor and cycling coach that we mentioned in last week's episode, who was known to supply his cyclists with performing enhancing drugs. Walsh would go on to publish a book in 2003 regarding the same, titled L.A. Confidential, that included a confession from Armstrong's masseuse, Emma O'Reilly, who said she had witnessed Armstrong and others on the USPS team doping. She had cleaned up syringes in the room, covered up their needle marks with makeup, and so on. Yeah. In typical Lance Armstrong fashion, he sued O'Reilly for defamation and attempted to discredit her publicly by calling her an alcoholic and a whore. Those were his exact words.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So that's who we're working with here.
Great.
When Armstrong won the Tour de France again in 2004, he made history by becoming the first cyclist to win 6 consecutive races. It's also in 2004 that those Livestrong bracelets became super popular. We talked about them briefly last week as part of Armstrong's Livestrong Foundation that helped raise awareness and support for cancer patients and survivors. Nike partnered alongside them and created these yellow silicone bracelets that said Livestrong on them and sold for $1 each. To this day, some 80 million of them have been sold. Everybody was wearing these things. In fact, I have like half a dozen pictures of celebrities wearing them for you to check out, Leah.
I was literally, when we were talking about this in the last episode, I was like, I kind of want to like search for it.
Well, now the moment has come. Yeah, because it was at this time in 2004 that they became really popular. So I want you just to name the celebrities as you see them in these pictures.
Lindsay Lohan.
Of course.
Looking fierce. Ben Stiller at a basketball game.
Yeah.
Will Ferrell.
Just looking like Will Ferrell.
Looking like Will Ferrell. And Ursher.
Ursher. There's actually one other one.
At a Teen Choice Awards thing. By the way. And Tom Hanks and Rita also wearing them.
And the thing about this one, especially to me, is like...
They're at the Oscars.
Yeah, they're on the red carpet. She looks phenomenal.
In like a gold sparkly dress.
A dress that probably costs $5,000 with her $1 silicone yellow bracelet.
Yeah, because Livestrong, bitches.
Everyone was wearing them.
Yeah.
Lance Armstrong was pretty damn popular. There were even people talking about him becoming governor or a senator. When he won his 7th consecutive Tour de France in 2005, he also set a record for completing the tour at the highest speed in history. His average speed throughout the tour was 26 miles per hour. He made an announcement this same year that the 2005 tour would be his last. I do find it interesting that it was this same year, 2005, when he chose to retire, that a French newspaper started reporting that Armstrong's 1999 samples from the very first tour that he won had been retested, which was also, remember, the same year when it had been found that he had cortisone in his system, and that this retesting had proved that he had been doping.
We're reading for Book Club, Catch and Kill by Ronan Farrow, and this reminds me a lot of it, where it's like, the people that these, like, investigative articles are about, they know, like, oh, they yeah. know that you're doing an article about them.
Oh, they always know. Yeah, that's a great reference, because yeah, in that book it's like Ronan Farrow is just kind of doing a little bit of snooping and a couple little interviews, and Harvey Weinstein and his entire team know instantly that he's doing a story on him.
So of course Lance is going to be like, this has to be my last year. Hey, I hopefully win 7 by the end of this year. And
yep. Exactly. It's no coincidence.
Yeah.
Regardless of all this, Armstrong continued to deny these allegations. In fact, during his 2005 winning speech, he said to all the critics, "I'm sorry you can't dream, and I'm sorry you don't believe in miracles." If you need a classic example of gaslighting, here you go.
Truly.
Yeah. "I'm sorry that you don't believe in miracles."
I have no comment. I
know. Well, I have nothing beyond saying that is a clear example of gaslighting. While Armstrong was enjoying retirement, hanging out with his best buddies like Jake Gyllenhaal and Matthew McConaughey. Sorry to ruin it for you. And he was also at this time divorcing his wife and mother of 3 children. And then immediately thereafter going on to date musician Sheryl Crow. Sorry to ruin them all for you. She's upset. This is the most upset she's been this whole episode. Let's check out what was going on in the world of cycling and doping, because things are about to get cray. Okay, if you are an avid podcast listener like me, I am confident that you have heard some of your favorite podcasters doing an ad for Madison Reed hair coloring. I am here to tell you that I actually use Madison Reed. I have been using Madison Reed for over a year now, and I am completely obsessed with it.
To avoid the time and cost of going to a hair salon, I have long been a box dye girl. I know, all of our hairdresser listeners are screaming right now. And you're totally right. After years of use, box dye completely stripped my hair of life. It was super dry and brittle and thin. And then I found Madison Reed. Madison Reed is free of ammonia, parabens, and so much more. It includes nutrients like keratin and ginseng root extract. So when I finish coloring my hair, not only is the color fantastic, but my hair actually feels good too. And it's super easy to use. You just go online to madison-reed.com, take an online quiz, and get matched to your perfect shade. The kit they send you comes with everything you will need, so you won't have to make any additional trips to the store. It includes gloves, bottles, barrier cream, cleansing wipes, a protective cap, and even color-protecting shampoo and conditioner to wash out your hair with afterward. With over 55 multi-dimensional shades to choose from and kits that start at only $22, Madison Reed comes highly recommended by me personally. Head to our website now at #history-pod.com, click on the promo code tab at the top of the screen, and use our link to get free shipping on your first order of Madison Reed.
In 2006, an operation titled Operation Puerto was conducted to look into Spanish sports doctor Eufemiano Fuentes. After having been implicated in a blood doping scandal, Spanish police forces arrested Fuentes and, upon raiding his place, found thousands of doses of steroids and blood transfusion machines. They also found, amongst his possessions, a list of cyclists he was treating. One name on this list was that of Jan Ulrich, the man who kept notoriously placing behind Armstrong in the Tour de France.
Ugh.
Yeah. As a result of these implications, only one day before the 2006 Tour was to commence, Ulrich was suspended from the race. A handful of other riders were also suspended, and although he was not suspended and would adamantly, at the time, deny being treated by Dr. Fuentes, another rider implicated in the scandal was a man named Tyler Hamilton, former team member of the United States Postal Service team that had helped Armstrong to tour victories three times.
How did he help Armstrong to tour victories?
That is a great question. So something to understand about the Tour de France and about being on a team competing in the Tour de France is that there is always one person from that team that is the leader and is selected as the guy chosen to win the tour. So when you compete in the Tour de France, even though it is an individual that wins, you're competing with a team.
Interesting.
Yeah. So if you are one of the team members, you're not the leader or whatever, you are a domestique, which in French generally translates to the word servant.
Like a domestic servant.
Exactly. It essentially means that you are in service to the leader. A lot of people refer to team members as the unsung heroes because it is their job to ensure the win for their team leader. So, like, you know, this team, you're all selected. There's someone that's selected as the leader. And it's their job to, you know, kind of like block other people, make sure that you have
trip
like a secure lead.
Throw their body down on the ground in front of the f-ing peloton. So everybody just starts piling up on top of them.
I mean, that is some very clever handiwork. I wouldn't put it past them. However, it mostly just means like just pushing your guy to the front.
Got it.
Your leader. Mm-hmm. That was a great question. So naturally, of course, there are going to be some team members that eventually want the opportunity and chance at winning too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One such person was Tyler Hamilton. After having been domestique for Armstrong in a number of his Tour de France wins, in 2001, Hamilton left the USPS team to become the leader of another team. In typical Armstrong fashion, Armstrong became an asshole to Hamilton following this career shift.
This part, like, I just don't get it.
I know.
I'm not a, well, I guess I kind of am a competitive person, like, when it comes to board games and stuff. But, like, I just don't understand. Like, obviously, that person is going to want a promotion.
I feel it both ways. I feel like, because the human element of me is you know, I'm competitive and maybe even some jealousy that, like, while everyone, of course, deserves a chance to actually have a chance.
Yeah.
And he never had a chance in the opportunity. If I'm saying, like, years removed, I can say, like, of course you made that decision for yourself.
Yeah.
And for your career development.
I'm not involved at all. I'm looking in from an outsider's perspective. I could see the jealousy aspect of Armstrong. But the thing that gets me is, like, he's won six races at the won six of them at this point. So yeah, like, there's literally no opportunity for the people, your domestiques, to, like,
there is no opportunity. That's part of their role when they come on, when they're, like, contracted, is you're not winning this thing. You're helping someone on your team win this thing.
I don't know. As an outsider, I'm like, this is stupid.
Of course. And you have to have understanding for someone, like, someone that's competing at this level, of course, naturally, unless you're the type of person that likes just supporting a team. Of course you want a chance to win.
Yeah.
And you don't have that chance if you are on a team, not as the leader.
Yeah.
So Hamilton, he does move over to another team. He becomes the leader. Armstrong's an asshole to him. Regardless, Hamilton competed in the Tour de France as the leader for a number of races, even competing and finishing in fourth place in the 2003 Tour de France, despite the fact that he had broken his collarbone during the first stage of the race.
Oh,
wild. But it would come crashing down in 2004 when, after winning the gold medal in the men's individual time trial at the Olympics in Athens, Hamilton's blood test would reveal that he had been doping.
Mm-hmm.
The following year, in 2005, the same year that Armstrong would retire from professional cycling, the United States Anti-Doping Agency would come after Hamilton and suspend him from the sport for 2 years. Although it has been denied, there has been some speculation that perhaps Armstrong, with his power, influence, and connections, was the one to encourage the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency to go after Hamilton.
Ugh.
It didn't help that at the same time, a lot of information was being revealed through legal discovery. In 2005, a company that Armstrong had worked with, called SCA Promotions, was withholding $5 million from him, money that he was owed, because they had come to believe that he had been doping during his tours. As part of this litigation, SCA took depositions of known associates of Armstrong to prove that he had been doping. Two such people that would be deposed were a married couple, Frankie and Betsy Andreu. Frankie had been a team member of Armstrong's, dating all the way back to his, like, Motorola days, and he had continued with him throughout his Tour de France races. In his deposition, he admitted to witnessing Armstrong doping several times, as well as doping himself. When Betsy was deposed, she told the story of how she remembered visiting Armstrong in the hospital several years before when he was undergoing cancer treatment. She said a doctor came in the room for a consultation. She, of course, you know, offered to leave, but Armstrong told her, no, it's cool. You can stick around. During this consultation, she heard when the doctor asked Armstrong if he had ever used any performance-enhancing drugs, to which Armstrong nonchalantly responded, yeah, and then started listing them off. Growth hormone, cortisone, EPO, steroids, and testosterone.
And this was a question that I was going to ask during the first part that I didn't, because I thought you would get to it. Is, like, did he disclose this to his cancer doctors? And were they in the know of all the things that he had done?
Great question. So we have this story that Betsy Andreu told, and I am inclined to believe her.
Yeah.
But throughout this, the discovery that occurred during this litigation, there were no medical records that proved that this encounter ever occurred. His doctors never corroborated her testimony. I'm inclined to believe her, but there was nothing else to corroborate it.
Yeah, because, I mean, if I'm a doctor treating a professional athlete, I could definitely see feeling pressure to not include that in the chart and in the medical records and everything.
Totally.
Yeah.
Armstrong denied these allegations. Surprise! And like I kind of already said, without any other witnesses really to corroborate the testimony, Armstrong would eventually be awarded a $7.5 million settlement. He would say of the settlement, "It's over. We won. They lost. I was yet again vindicated."
Ew.
I know. He's gross. And of anyone who asked, Armstrong would call Betsy a, quote, crazy bitch. The Andreus would also report receiving threatening messages on their answering machine. The depositions were obviously part of a court case that, you know, was intended to remain sealed. But when they were released, the Los Angeles Times dropped a huge article about it in 2006. This article was pretty damning. It would state that expert witnesses interviewed as part of the SCA litigation had confirmed that Armstrong samples provided, at least in his 1999 tour, were consistent with someone that was doping. The article would also include an instant messaging string between Frankie Andreu and another cyclist on the team in which they openly admitted to doping during the tour. And although the SCA case would end up being ruled in favor of Armstrong, this LA Times article would really begin to plant doubt in the public's mind in relation to his doping denials.
If doping is raised into question so many times,
that's your answer.
There's a reason for that.
Yes. There. What is the phrase? No smoke without fire?
Yeah.
They're all just being haters.
They're just jealous.
Exactly. It was also in 2006 that the Floyd Landis scandal would begin. Landis, a professional cyclist, had been on Armstrong's team during the 2002, 2003, and 2004 tours. In 2006, the year after Armstrong had retired, Landis joined the Phonak team as the leader in an attempt to win the Tour de France for himself. Most didn't believe we would see another American win the Tour so soon after Armstrong's retirement. Armstrong himself told Landis this, but to many's surprise, especially given that Landis was competing on a severely injured hip, Landis would win the Tour de France in 2006. But only a few days after his victory, the Phonak team announced that Landis's blood samples had come back positive for performance-enhancing drugs. This is like, tell us all that's time, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Like they all do, Landis denied the allegations and asked them to test his backup sample instead. So they did, and the backup sample also tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs. I love that he like had the like hubris to say like my backup one will be fine.
Well, the other thing I think we have to remember is in 1998, so only what, 6 or 7? What is math?
What is math? Yeah, eight-ish years.
8 years uh-huh. prior to this,
that wasn't
like mm-hmm. they would test drugs and it was up in the air, and things would come back negative, even though we later found out they were positive.
Yeah,
like. Testing and science hadn't gotten that far. So I could see yep. being like cocky about it and be like, oh no, just test my secondary sample.
That is really good perspective. In addition to like, these people are professionals and they're very clever and they know, the doctors are too. They know when to dope, when not to dope, mm-hmm. when you're going to be tested, when you're most likely not to be tested. So I do see your point that he maybe could have had a shot with his backup sample.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Landis was stripped of his win and would be banned from professional cycling for 2 years. He attempted to return to cycling the minute that he could, but no one took him seriously at this point. He struggled to find a team and sponsors after his doping scandal.
Yeah.
So that made it hurt all the more when in 2009...
So fresh, so fine, you wish you were 9.
Again, someone's graduating class. Lance Armstrong announced that he was returning to cycling and would be competing in the Tour de France again. He began working with Michele Ferrari again, a relationship we discussed, you know, in our part one episode. Ferrari warned Armstrong that if he crossed the finish line and if he placed in the race, there would be no way to conceal that he had been doping. It just wasn't possible to be away from the sport for so long and to return as a winner without assistance of performance-enhancing drugs.
Yeah.
In fact, when Armstrong announced his return, former Tour de France director Jean-Marie LeBlanc wrote an open letter to him in which he said, if you don't mind reading it, Leah.
Yeah. Us former riders generally have respect for winners, but that's not always the case with the public and above all the media who have heavy suspicions about you. The hounds will be let loose. Column inches will be written. Images repeated and debate sparked about the one word which has petrified our passion over the past 10 years. Doping.
Armstrong would win third place at the 2009 Tour de France. Mm. He founded the Radio Shack team in 2010 and would compete as their leader the following year in the Tour de France, but would finish in 23rd place.
All of these sponsors are like,
I know,
relics of the past.
I know. If nothing screams like
Motorola, Radio Shack.
Oh, yeah. All of it. Yeah. In 2011, he officially retired from cycling at the age of 39. It continues to be a debate if Armstrong was clean in his last two tours. He insists that he was, but very few people believe that.
Yeah.
To see the ease at which Armstrong seemingly returned to the sport after his own doping rumors had been circling for a decade really pissed Floyd Landis off. In spring of 2010, Landis had had enough. He sent out a series of emails to officials in the cycling world, as well as those in the anti-doping organizations, in which he admitted himself to doping from 2002 to 2006. In these emails, he also implicated several of his former teammates, which included none other than Lance Armstrong. In fact, he alleged that he himself had not begun doping until 2002, the first tour that he competed in on Armstrong's team. He alleged that he had not only witnessed Armstrong doping, but that Armstrong was the instigator and the one encouraging the rest of the team to do the same.
Yeah, I can see that.
Mm-hmm. He's a bully.
Yeah.
He also alleged that Armstrong had paid off the governing body of cycling, UCI, to ignore his positive blood test. Armstrong, of course, denied these allegations, saying, quote, "It's our word against his word. I like our word. We like our credibility. Floyd lost his credibility a long time ago." And although this response is totally pompous and arrogant, he wasn't completely off base. Landis had lost his credibility. No one liked him back when he lied about doping in the 2006 Tour de France. And then when he did admit to doping years later and dragged along several other former teammates, he was now viewed as a rat.
Mm-hmm. Especially by Armstrong.
Especially by Armstrong. But petty drama aside, the emails Landis sent were enough for the U.S. Justice Department to open a federal investigation into Armstrong's alleged doping. They were able to get several of Armstrong's former teammates to admit that they had witnessed Armstrong doping. This was further corroborated by a 2011 60 Minutes interview that Armstrong's former teammate, Tyler Hamilton, whom we mentioned earlier, did, in which he would spill all the beans about him and Armstrong doing EPO together during the 1999, 2000, and 2001 tours. After a two-year-long criminal investigation, though, federal prosecutors would drop the case against Armstrong and would not file charges. There has been no explanation as to why the investigation was closed, but there has been some speculation that Armstrong was able to use his influence and connections to encourage them to do so.
Mm-hmm.
However, the United States Anti-Doping Agency would pick up where the federal government left off. With the help of more than two dozen witnesses and all of the evidence gathered in the federal investigation, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency was able to formally charge Armstrong with using, possessing, and trafficking banned substances. They released a pretty damning statement in October of 2012, if you don't mind reading it, Leah.
Yeah, forgive me if I slur. The evidence shows beyond any doubt that the U.S. Postal Service pro cycling team ran the most sophisticated, professionalized, and successful doping program that sport has ever seen. The evidence of the U.S. Postal Service pro cycling team run scheme is overwhelming and is in excess of 1,000 pages, and includes sworn testimony from 26 people, including 15 riders, with knowledge of the U.S. Postal Service team, USPS team, and its participants' doping activities. The evidence also includes direct documentary evidence, including financial payments, emails, scientific data, and laboratory test results that further prove the use, possession, and distribution of performance-enhancing drugs by Lance Armstrong, and confirm the disappointing truth about the deceptive activities of the USPS team, a team that received tens of millions of American taxpayer dollars in funding.
Yeah, I think, and you brought up the question in our part one episode. Again, if you haven't listened to that one yet, highly recommend you do that. You brought it up that, like, how could we go this long without just knowing that for sure he did dope?
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, we've made it now. It's 2012 is when the United States Anti-Doping Agency officially finally said.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying, of course, I mean, there were suspicions. And so anyone that believed beforehand is obviously correct.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you want to believe the best, regardless of, you know, what rumors are out there.
Yeah.
There wasn't definitive proof until 2012.
I feel like the general public, like, yeah, until there's a governing body of some sort or the government or something is like, yes, this happened. And there's proof that is unquestionable proof that is presented. Cool. But like people in the industry, if you will, or in the sport, that's where I'm like, they know what's possible. They know what's possible and what's not.
I think a lot of them did, and that they were either paid off or just scared of him.
Yeah.
As a result of this investigation, Armstrong was banned from professional cycling for life and was stripped of all seven of his Tour de France titles. In response to this, Armstrong tweeted, "Back in Austin and just laying around," accompanied by this picture.
Oh, no. It's a picture of him with all of his jerseys as, like, they're, like, framed as art in his house on his ginormous couch, just laying on the couch.
That's his response. It's super cocky. It's him saying, like, cool, you can take away my titles.
But
I'm
you
still
can't take away my f***ing mansion and my artwork.
Yep, exactly.
And the jerseys and...
Exactly. Armstrong's sponsors responded a little less smugly than him. Shortly after the decision by UCI to ban Armstrong from the sport indefinitely, all of his sponsorship deals fell apart. Oakley, Nike, Trek, and others all dropped Armstrong. In his words, he stated that he lost roughly $75 million in one day.
Mm-hmm.
Not long after, Armstrong's own nonprofit cancer support organization, Livestrong, also dropped him. Armstrong would continue to deny the allegations until 2013 when he sat down with Oprah for an exclusive interview. Did you watch this interview at the time?
I've probably seen clips, and maybe at the time I watched it, okay. I don't like have a very strong remembrance of it.
Okay. And I mean, we've kind of already talked about this, I think mostly in our part one episode, but I like very closely followed the story. So I remember like scheduling out and making sure I could watch this interview live.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, let's do like a little bit of role play here just to read just the opening of the interview. Do you want to be Oprah or Armstrong?
Stupid question.
Why did I ask that?
Oprah.
Okay. So you will be Oprah. I will be Armstrong. It's pretty wild because Oprah just, she just starts this interview off with a handful of yes or no questions. And I just remember at the time watching it, like literally like screaming in the first 2 minutes of this interview. Oprah, take it away.
Okay. Yes or no. Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance? Pause, because like, what a badass woman to just start off the interview.
That's what
that.
She said. And she starts it off even more badass than that. She says, we have plenty of time here today. I don't want your details. I want yes or no's.
Okay.
That's how she starts off the interview.
Okay.
We have time for details later. Yes or no's for now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Continuing. Yes or no. Was one of those banned substances EPO?
Yes.
Did you ever blood dope or use blood transfusions to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
Did you ever use any other banned substances like testosterone, cortisone, or human growth hormone?
Yes.
Yes or no, in all seven of your Tour de France victories, did you ever take banned substances or blood dope?
Yes. Yeah, exactly my reaction. I just remember being like blown away when I was watching this live because, I mean, we all already knew it at this point, but it's just something else when you actually hear it coming out of his mouth after so long of denying it.
Yeah.
In fact, I thought we might do just really quickly one other little script here, not necessarily role play, but I thought you and I could bounce back and forth and read off just some, these aren't even all, but some of Armstrong's doping denials from the beginning of his career through to his Oprah confession.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. You want to take the first one?
Yeah. 1999, quote, I have been on my deathbed and I'm not stupid. I can emphatically say I am not on drugs.
2004. I have never had a single positive doping test and I do not take performance enhancing drugs.
Again, in 2004. We're sick and tired of these allegations and we're going to do everything we can to fight them. They're absolutely untrue.
2005. I have never doped. I can say it again, but I've said it for 7 years.
Again in 2005. How many times do I have to say it? It can't be any clearer than I've never taken drugs.
2010. As long as I live, I will deny it. There was absolutely no way I forced people, encouraged people, told people, helped people, facilitated. Absolutely not. 100%.
And 2011. 20 plus year career, 500 drug controls worldwide, in and out of competition, never a failed test. I rest my case.
Again, at this point, we all knew the truth. But after years of lies, manipulation, and gaslighting, hearing him finally admit it on national television to Oprah Winfrey was really, really something. Armstrong would get hit with lawsuit after lawsuit following his confession. In 2013, the U.S. government joined a whistleblower lawsuit Floyd Landis had initiated in which he claimed that Armstrong had defrauded the federal government. Instead of going to trial and potentially losing $100 million, Armstrong chose to settle the suit in 2018 for $5 million. There was also an insurance lawsuit that settled for an undisclosed amount, but we know the insurance company was initially seeking $3 million in damages. He also had to pay $10 million as part of a perjury lawsuit. We also know that in 2018, he sold his more than 8,000 square foot mansion in Austin, Texas, for a 3-bedroom, 3,000 square foot home.
Ooh. I also, and we kind of mentioned it, mm-hmm. I don't know if it was this episode or last, but mm-hmm. like his main sponsor, U.S. Postal Service, that's like a government entity. It's taxpayer money.
For defrauding the federal government.
Yeah, like mm-hmm. you're literally taking taxpayer money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just, it speaks to his level of narcissism.
Yeah, like he's comfortable taking...
He's said that. Like in his interviews, he now absolutely admits that like what I did was wrong, but he has said, I would do it again. I would cheat again.
Ew. Mm-hmm. Ew, I would Rachel. Cheat again.
Gross, right? Nowadays, Armstrong continues to be involved in cycling, although, of course, not professionally. He has since had two more kids with his partner, Anna Hansen. He also owns a coffee shop and a bike shop in Austin, Texas, and he's the host of two podcasts.
Ew, don't listen to them.
And that's the rise and fall of Lance Armstrong.
Yeah, there it is.
There she is. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Hashtag History.
We will share the pictures we discussed in this episode to our Instagram, and all sources used to put together this episode can be found on our website at hashtaghistory-pod.com.
Subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you use. Share about us with your family and friends, and we would love it so much if you would give us a rate and review on Apple Podcast.
Be sure to check us out on all of our socials. You can find us on Instagram at hashtag history_podcast, on TikTok at #history, and on Twitter if you want to follow an unenthusiastic, uninvolved
archived
podcast. You can find us on there at #history_.
That's the perfect way to describe it. And we would love it so much if you would come join our Patreon. We have a lot of fun over there. It's only $1 a month, and if you join the Patreon, it goes directly to supporting our books and booze supply. And for you all, we make sure you get access to behind-the-scenes content. We drop weekly #hangout episodes. We mail you cards and stickers. 15% off merchandise. All the good stuff.
All the goods.
All the goods. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
I don't feel that one. I thought I was expecting to.
Ditto.
I found a cute little... Ow, God. I know they're wearing cups, but like they're dicks, man.
Right? But like they're dicks, man. An Irish sports writer named... No, there's a bunch of pictures of him and Gyllenhaal and McConaughey, like, biking together, running together.
I like McConaughey, too.
Yeah. And they
He's
were, like...
from Texas, so I get
And they
that.
Were very recently, and, like, in the last few years, they still talk. Him and McConaughey. I don't know about him and Gyllenhaal.
I don't like that.
Yeah.
I don't like that at all. Okay.
Sorry to ruin people for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, that's great.
Jeez. For our, my God. Dopen room.
A dopen roomers. I can empathetically say I am not.
I think
not.
It's emphatically. I'm sure he was empathetic too.
No, he wasn't. No.